Yeah, this is exactly what the Gemara Megillah means. Remember, the Gemara Megillah says that the onus of the Uziel, the greatest of the Talmidim of Hillel, wrote a targum on the Vim, the targum the onus on. And then he began to write a targum on Ksuvim. And then there was an earthquake in Eretz Yisrael where Hashem's word did not let him do it because me, Gila, the one I Rasa, who was able to reveal the secrets. And the pshat is very simple, that in the Ksuvim, particularly the book of Daniel, there is a detailed calculation as to when the Mashiach will come. There are formulas. There are actually five different dating systems that Hashem's word used in communicating to Daniel when will be the case. Of course, even the case is not so question. Does case mean Mashiach? Does it mean Tzias Amazek? Even that exact Nakuda is not clear, but there are five different systems, and if you look at Rashi, Rashi tries to reconcile all the systems that are not the same, Ramban, and basically in the time of the Kohenim and the Rishonim, they tried to figure out what those Cheshbonos were, and they came up with different dates, and all of those dates passed, so according to Rashi, it was typically like 100 or so years ahead of where you were. So if Sadia Gain put it in the 1000s, and Rashi put it in the 1100s, and the Ramban put it in the 1200s. The last of our Mefarshim that tried to do that was the Malbim. The Malbim wrote in the 1900s, and the Malbim came up with the 1800s, 19th century, and the Malbim came up with 1920, as you know, so Mashiach basis understanding of the Pesukim. Now there are two different issues I want to discuss here. Issue number one is, what about the fact that Chazal actually say, Chazal pronounce a curse on those who try to calculate, machashvei keitz, those who try to figure out when Mashiach comes. Tipach rucham. They should burst. They should be destroyed. So how could all these Rishonim be machashvei keitz? And it's so interesting. In one of the letters of the Rambam, somebody asked him about Mashiach and different calculations. So the Rambam quotes all the Mamari Chazal that you shouldn't do it, it's usher to do, it's no good to do, it's bad to do. This is, but you know, my father gave me a remez that he had from his So the Malbim tries to be Miyashu. The Malbim gives a teretz, but it's a very short teretz. The Malbim tries to say that the Isra of being Mechashiv Kates is only when the date that you've seen is a date that's long in the future. Tell people that the date of Mashiach is going to be, you know, 1,000 years from now, they're going to be tzubrachen, they're going to be heartbroken, they're going to give up hope, and they're not going to realize, of course, that even if there's an outside date, we can always accelerate Mashiach early. Mashiach, the Malbim says, when your date is in the near future, that's not going to be a problem. Now, Landia's date is a very short heritage because, if anything, I think to come up with a close date is much worse, potentially, than a far date. Because a close date, the date comes and it goes and it doesn't happen, what's going to happen to people? If anything, people might get more surprised. So the Malbim Svara only makes sense if you know your date is right. If you know your date is right, so no, I'm going to tell you in 10 years Mashiach is going to come. But if you really don't know, you're just giving pshatim in a pasuk, then pufa care. It seems the sarkana of a recent date is more dangerous than a long-term date. Now, the second kasha I want to raise is, so what's the pshat? If Sadia Gaon comes up with a date, and actually it's very interesting, it's very fascinating, I guess, in terms of pshat and the psukim, the ingenuity, because the psukim are so obscure, so difficult, and to be able to enter the psukim, it's very, very fascinating, but all the dates are wrong. Sadia Gaon's date was wrong, Rashi's date is wrong, Ramban's date is wrong, Talmud's date is wrong. So what's the pshat? Say that the Rishonim made mistakes. So here you have to understand a very important thing about, I'd say, biblical prophecy in general. That is, HaKadosh Baruch Hu often gives nevuah that can be interpreted in many, many different ways. And which way it will happen is totally on the zechus of Am Yisrael. So the emphasis of that is, it's not the pshat, the nevuah meant a particular date and not the other dates. The nevuah was bedafka worded that each of those dates could have been a zaman of his iris of Gehula had we been worthy. So Rav Sadia Gaon's date was a possibility. And in fact, different svarim try to do this, although I can't say I have a full grasp of it. They try to show that in each of those years there were certain events that were merames to Gehula in Rav of Sagittarian states and Rashi states and Ramban states, and even in the Malbim states. So the concept is this: when a nevuah is obscure, it's not the pshat, it has a single meaning, and you're trying to find out what that meaning is. Rather, the meaning is indeterminate, and it will be chal based on Yisus of Yisrael. A very good example in the Torah itself is the 400 years of the Brisbane of Summer. HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Abraham, your children will be enslaved in a land that is not theirs for 400 years. Now we know that they were only in Mitzrayim 210 years, and you counted from the birth of Yitzchak and the like, but the Mepharshim tell us that the MS is it could have taken many, many different forms. It could have been counted from here, we would have stayed longer had we not been on the 40-month level of Tuma. We should have stayed longer, I'll leave it the MS, the Sforim say, had we stayed the extra 190 years in Mitzrayim, we would have been purified from our Zuhama, but the problem was we would have hit the 50th level, so we couldn't have gone through that process. It's like chemotherapy that kills the patient. So what's Elamai? So HaKadosh Baruch Hu gave the Nevuah in a way that it could be fulfilled this way, or that way, or that way, or that way, and any of those ways would have been a valid key of the Nevuah. Okay, so you can look at the book Daniel, and again, I think what the article does in the Marshall is it does give you the different calculations. Obviously, the article does not take sides and when Mashiach is going to come. It's not going to tell you. But the Rishonim did use the book of Daniel as a mafteach. By the way, the well-known Masorah of Chazal, that the Bayis Sheni was 420 years. And this is actually very, very problematical in terms of secularism, because it seems that the second temple was much longer. But it's miyusad on a verse of Daniel, what was machriach Chazal, come up with 420 years was that the Pasuk says Hashem was Geyser on Yerushalayim 70 weeks. Now a week in that Pasuk means 7 years, it's called a Shavuah. 70 weeks is 490 years. Chazal understood that Pasuk to mean that from the Churban Bayis Rishon to the Churban Bayis Sheni is 490 years, and since we know from the Churban Bayis Rishon to the Binyan Bayis Sheni, 7 years, 490 minus 70 leaves you with 420. So it's the Cheshbon of Seder HaOlam, which is the Chazal's chronological work, is based on Shivim Shavuos, on Nixon. So Daniel is a very, very interesting book in terms of going through the different Rishonim on it. Dr. Barbanel wrote literally three different Svarim on Daniel. One is a pasuk by pasuk pshat, like the Rambam writes generally, and the other we're trying to explain the messianic practice. Came up in another day around the Spanish Inquisition, that many, many people thought that was the Gaigu Maga that would be the precursors of it. By the way, I want to correct something I said. I kept on using the words nevuas, nevuas, nevuas. Now let's think about that for a moment. Sefer Daniel, although there are so many predictions about the future, obviously, Daniel is not in the Sifrei Nevi'im. Daniel is in the Sifrei Kesuvim. And one might ask Natasha, what's the Nafka Mina? And in fact, Mar Megillah says Daniel was not an Ovid. What's the chat Daniel was not an Ovid? I understand why Tehillim was said, so Tehillim are praises of Hashem. All right, but why would the Sefer like Daniel not be called Nevuah? Why would Daniel not be an Ovid? He had future visions communicated just to him by HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The answer is this. This is a very important insight. What makes a Navi is not that he sees the future. Great Sadiqah can be seen in the future. What makes them a Navi is they are commanded by HaKadosh Baruch Hu to communicate the message to Am Yisrael. The word Navi does not refer to what you see. Navi means gives to Messiah. And although Daniel was the repository of great, great future understandings, they were given to him as a private matana, so to speak, from the Ribbono Shel Olam, as he was not commanded. He was allowed to write them down, but he was not commanded to be mefarsed in them. In fact, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's lesson was, write them down and keep them obscure. So as a result, Daniel had tremendous havana, but Daniel was not a Navi. and that's why he's favoring the student.
How do we understand the idea of Plegish? I guess.
Well, it's a big machlokish for Shiner. How do you understand Plegish? According to the Rambam, Plegish. Now again, first of all, there are two questions here. First of all, what is a Plegish? That's one question number one. Question number two is when is a Plegish permitted, and when is it forbidden? What is a Plegish? We have a machlokish. One opinion says a pilegesh is a woman that you have not married, same mistress, but she's not a prostitute. She has a permanent relationship with you, but she without marriage. That's a pilegesh, not a wedlock, steady relationship as opposed to a promiscuous one. According to another opinion, a pilegesh is married, but it's an agreement not to have a ksuba. So there's a machlokas. Is it a pilegesh b'li kedushin? Or is it Pilagesh Kedushin, B'li Kesuvah? Most Rishayim say Pashut Pilagesh is without Kedushin. So let's go with that definition. But Machlokas number two is, when is a Pilagesh Mutter? So according to the Rambam, it is Usur D'Oraisa for a regular Jewish person to have relations with a woman outside of marriage. It's an Usur D'Oraisa, it's a love. It's not a Chiyuv Kares, there's no Mamzeres, but it is a love. And the whole letter of Pilagesh is a special rule only for a melech. It is the prerogative of a melech. A melech has many, many prerogatives, many, many zechuyos, and pilegesh is one of them. This is how we generally pass it. So unless somebody's a melech, we would consider pilegesh to be usur d'oraisa. However, not to be totally honest, there is a minority of shonen, and the Nachman, like Yaakov Emden, often has kind of unusual nasiyotif opinions, who actually says that Mahalakha is a pilegesh mutter even to a hedgeite, and we're not getting into various scandals in New York and other places. There is a small segment of the religious community that has used Rabbi Yaakov Emden. It's a mutter thing that the Torah community would generally not permit. Let me point out a very simple thing, though. That is that even if a pilegesh is mutter, certainly a pilegesh that's a neither would not be mutter. So then you would have to create a whole scenario where single women would be married to the marriage. That's what pilegesh is.
So the
rabbi
said that
it
doesn't produce mamzeria, but
see, Baruch Hashem,
what does it produce? Does it produce equal inheritors?
Yes, it does. It does. A child born out of First of all, even a momser would have a sequel. Even if, God forbid, a woman were to commit adultery and have a child from a man that's married, the momser would inherit equally with the man's, the adulterer's other children and the like. So without the inheritance, momseris doesn't do anything to you. But the momser has prohibitions on who to marry, who he or she can marry. But a child born out of wedlock, the Baruch Hashem, has no disabilities at all. And let me tell you why that's an extremely important bit of information to know. Most people that say who are chosrei b'tshuva, good, their parents were not living out of wedlock in a sense the way we normally understand it. But keep in mind that if they didn't have a kosher marriage, they didn't have kosher eidim, it's entirely possible that in the eyes of halacha, their parents' marriage is not a marriage. And if in the eyes of halacha, their parents' marriage are not a marriage, then they are born out of wedlock. That shouldn't scare anybody, because being born out of wedlock is not a problem. By two things, Hashem had rachamim because he saw, first of all, he knew that there would be a home movement to Bali Tshuva. One is that out of wedlock relationships don't produce mamzer. And the other is a relationship with a need that doesn't produce a mamzer. Now, in truth, that's an exception from the rule, because the normal rule of mamzer is any relationship in which the punishment is kares produces mamzer. By that definition, a ben nida ought to be a mamzer. But imagine how many mamzerim there would be if there would be such a halacha. So Baruch Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu said, the child of a nida is not a mamzer, there is no problem. And the other thing that's amazingly helpful is it actually is helpful in some cases. to have parents who are not halakhically married. And this is extremely helpful if you are, for example, a child born from a second marriage, and your mom did not get a get from her first marriage. So you got a real problem here, theoretically, because if mom didn't get a get from her first marriage, she's still married to her first husband. So when she, even with a civil divorce, so when she marries husband number two, the child would be conceivably a mom's heir. But we rely on a very well-known psak of Moshe Feinstein that says that if marriage number one did not have kosher edim, it is therefore invalid, and an invalid marriage does not need a get. If it does not need a get, then marriage number two does not produce mamzerim. And if you're going to say, oh, but if you're invalidating marriage number one, you're also invalidating marriage number two, which may have been non-halachic, but that's okay, because invalidating marriage number two just means you're born out of wedlock. It's a lot better to be born out of wedlock than to be a mamzer. So this works out well. Now, not all the posts agreed with Rav Moshe. The emphasis of Rav Yosef Lechatzchila was also machmer. There are posts that say that even if a marriage is initially invalid, if they live together as husband and wife, and there are religious people who are aware of that, they become the witnesses, making it a marriage. Which means, according to this psak, civil marriages, reform marriages, can morph into halachic marriages simply by them living together with other religious Jews knowing about it. This was the psak of Rav Henkin, who was very chashuv of Paisek, you know, slightly older than Rav Moshe, and the like. But as I say, at least when it comes to Mamzeris,
and it requires a get.
It certainly requires a get, yeah. But more than that, requiring a get is not as serious as the child being Mamzer. But regarding being Mamzeris, the Torah world is presently making, like Rav Moshe.
Does the Pelagius do so? You need the permission, does the husband need permission of the wife as like to allow the relationship or no?
You think about Pelagius, no?
Yeah.
Oh, don't go back to be like it. No, it's an interesting question because under Torah law, of course, a husband can marry two wives, and you don't need your wife's consent. But at least for Ashkenazim, since the 1100s, since the 11th century, the 1000s, we have the famous Takana of Rabbeinu Gershom. You all heard of Rabbeinu Gershom, who's varied and enormously great. He was the Rebbe of Rashi's Rebbe, before Rashi. And Rabbeinu Gershom made a takana for the Jews in Germany and Poland, Ashkenazi Jews, that there's a prohibition of polygamy. And so I'm not allowed to marry another wife. The question becomes, and that's even if she gives me permission. Now, those who monitor Pilagesh say that since Pilagesh is without marriage, you're not marrying another wife, you're just having a mistress. And that's not having another wife, so you do not need the wife's permission. But I would not recommend it for Sholem Pikes' concerns, if for no other reason. But besides that, let me just reemphasize that according to the Rambam, for a non-melech to have a Pilegesh would in fact be a Torah prohibition. It wouldn't just be a Sholem Pikes type of. By the way, yes, I mentioned Ashkenazim. So two things about Rabbeinu Gershom's ban. There are actually two things he banned at the same time. Number one, he prohibited polygamy, taking another wife. And number two, he prohibited divorcing a woman against her will. Now, all you guys know from your learning in the 8th paragraph of Gittin, that the Torah basically allows me to throw a get in my wife's courtyard and all sorts of things, whether she likes it or not. That's all the law of the Torah, and even the Rabbanan. But according to Rabbeinu Gershom, a man is not allowed to, unless she consents, generally speaking, we do not allow him to divorce her, right? So as a result, he can't marry another wife, and he cannot divorce her against her will, which means the question about Buddha, when a woman is stuck because a man doesn't give her a get, can also apply to a man. If a woman refuses to receive a get, he could be stuck with the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom. Now, there are two things people say. A smart Alex always like to tell you, if you looked at Rabbeinu Gershom's ban, it was only until the year 5000. It had an expiration date, and therefore it expired 774 years ago, and therefore it's mutter. Well, all of that is true, but the Beis Yosef informs us that the ban was extended by the later Chachamim, so it's in effect. But the second thing is that since Rabbi Gershom's jurisdiction, so to speak, was only among Ashkenazic communities, which is a broad category, really, in Germany, Poland, Lithuania, Russia, it did not embrace Sephardic communities, which are really North Africa, Syria, Iraq, those countries. So technically, Sephardim were Arabic to Arabic. And indeed, the Yemenites came back to Israel first in 1940. There were some older people. I don't think they're alive today, but they were brought multiple lives. But what Sephardim do this very day is they have a, what you might call, a privatization of the ban of Rabbeinu Gershom. Meaning, in the Sephardic Ksuba, which is much longer than Ashkenazic Ksuba, they actually say that the Chassan swears with a severe oath that he will not take another wife over this wife, and if he does so, he will immediately divorce the first wife with $1 million Ksuba. They put in a huge Ksuba, which basically says, yeah, you're free to violate, you're free to marry another wife, but if you do so, you're going to have to pay my daughter, you know, $2 million. So that's what you might call a privatization of the Chaimer of Rabbeinu Gershom. Also, in 1948, the two chief, or 40, maybe 1950, the two chief rabbis, the Ashkenazic chief rabbi was Rabbi Yitzchak Herzog, and the Sephardic was Rabbi Zeal. They made a joint takana, that Sephardim and Eretz Yisrael would be Makabel, the Chaimer of Rabbeinu Gershom. And as a result, based on that takana, except for the grandfather clause allowing people who already had multiple wives, Sephardim are bound by that takana. On the other hand, I saw a tshuva from Ravadja Yosef, who actually says that the Sephardic chief rabbi didn't have the power to give away the minhag of Sephardim to allow something. So he actually says the takana of his predecessor on Sephardim was batel u'mavutal, so there's even a machlokas. If Sephardim in Eretz Yisrael were bound by the takana, again, Rabbi had a whole sheet of that. He felt that Sephardic rabbis were giving up too much authority to the Ashkenazic rabbis, and they had no right to just sell them out, so to speak. So there's a big machlokas among Sephardim whether there is a takana in Eretz Yisrael that they cannot, that they're bound by sales.
What is Kabbana?
Yeah, well, that's a good question. In fact, a friend of mine, not a friend, but at least acquaintance I know from Connecticut, wrote a very, very nice book in English. It's around 600 pages, called Kabbana. So you might want to look it up somewhere to go through all the different sources. What is Kabbana? And there are different forms of Kabbana. The word Kabbana literally means direction, focus. The chaven is to direct my hand, right? Even if I want to move something, I want to get something, so I have to be mechaven my yad, right? So kavana is direction, and it really means focus thought. The problem is that our minds are distracted constantly, seeing things, thinking of things, many, many different thoughts pass through our minds. We get distracted. We get distracted in everything. We get distracted in learning. If you're talking to me, my mind might be thinking about some problem I have, or what I'm going to eat for dinner tonight, and you might be thinking of something else, right? So, one of the most difficult things for a human being to accomplish is to focus on a simple thing. Meditation is directed to that idea of learning to focus by shutting up. So, consequently, kavana is not a term that is miyuchad to prayer. Kavana is the general idea of focus. Focus without distraction, without static, without other things coming into your mind. Now, for tefillah, there is a special rule that in tefillah, you have to be mechaven as you go. So I want to emphasize, people make a mistake. We sometimes think kavana is connected to understanding what you're saying. I mean, not really. It's true that if you understand what you're saying, you can focus better. And it's true there are other halachas that you're supposed to understand certain parts of davening. Not that many, by the way. You have to understand the first pasuk of Shema, and you have to understand the first brach in Shemoneh Esrei. The rest of Shemoneh Esrei, even if you don't know what you're saying, you're a yotzei. But kavana would mean that you're focused, that you're speaking to Hashem, and you don't allow other things. Now again, for Shteitzach, there's a very close relationship between knowing what you're saying and having kavana, but they are two different concepts. The kavana is not to be distracted by other thoughts. That's what kavana. That's a very, very difficult thing. Rabbi Kaplan, Aleph Shalom, was a big proponent of kosher forms of meditation. He wrote three books on meditation. Jewish meditation, meditation in the Bible, and meditation on the Kabbalah. The library here, if you find anything in the library here, probably has at least one of those books. I'm not sure which one, but I'm sure one of the three is up there. Now, Rabbi Kaplan claimed a lot of benefits to meditation. He claimed that meditation was the main activity in the Nevi'im schools. We read in Tanakh, there was a group of people called B'nai HaNevi'im. Now, B'nai HaNevi'im means the children of the prophets, but that means the students of the prophets. Which implied there were schools you went to learn prophecy. But how can you learn prophecy? Prophecy is a gift from Hashem, the Rambam says. I mean, no matter what your techniques, you know, you're not going to automatically be a prophet. So the Rambam explains, that's true. A lot of people who graduated maybe didn't get the job of being a prophet. But, the Rambam says, in addition to Hashem giving you gifts, there are techniques that make you receptive to receive the Ruach. And Rabbi Kaplan claimed, primarily, there were different techniques of advanced meditation in which, if you can get rid of the distractions, you can receive the divine light. So he claimed that that was Hachana for the Ruach. He also said that when the Mishnah Brachos tells us that the Hasidim are Rishonim, the early pious people, these are not the Baal Shem Tovs, as he mentioned much earlier, they used to spend an hour before davening, and then they would daven an hour after davening. He connected that to meditative states to be able to get it done. So he claims that the notion of focused meditation is a very, very long Yisrael in Israel. And I can't necessarily judge it historically, but there's no question that what do you call it? Maybe what you call it doesn't make a difference, but certainly taking time before sleep to kind of focus the thoughts, calm yourself down, not to be agitated, not to be nervous, is the way that you can focus your thoughts. Now, there's an interesting machlokas among contemporary Gedolim, Rabbanim, Hasidish rabbis about pacing. There are some rabbis who actually take the position that, at least in their own avodah, it's better to daven very quickly than very slowly. They actually daven. There are great Hasidish rabbis who daven the Shemoneh Esrei like 3 minutes because they feel they can have this intense, focused concentration if they kind of stretch out the words. So long, you know, they stretch out the words, their mind is going to want to so to speak. So there is a sheet that better to daven quick than daven slow. Others say you daven slow, you can concentrate, etc. Certainly one of the problems we have when you go, the yeshiva is slower than a shul about a bottom. Certainly if you go back to America, the pace in virtually every shul is going to be very, very difficult. And what's worse is, I know this, if you ever have to daven for the omelet, a fast shul, very, very, very uncomfortable. Because in addition to having to daven fast, which you can do, theoretically it's possible to be focused and daven fast. But when you're nervous that somebody's going to be yelling at you, that creates a lot of anxiety, and that shoots out the money. What destroys kavanah is the sense of somebody breathing down your back. So the whole shaila in halacha, should that pater me from tefillah b'tzibur? Meaning, if my only choice, because I don't have a million choices in most places in America, if my only choice is super fast minyan, or davening b'yechidus, so it's an interesting shiloh. Certainly, you should go to the minyan at least to hear Kaddish, Kedusha, Kriya, Sefer. That doesn't talk to you. But the question is, the etzem tefillah, some would say it's better to daven in Yechidus. And then join the shul. Again, join the shul. Kaddish, Kedusha, Baruch Hu, and Kriya, Sefer. In fact, there were many Gedolim that did that. It's interesting. That's not so much monolithic. The many Chassidish, even the Chassidish often did. Chassidish often did. Chassidish often daven b'yechidus, and he would join. There was actually a minyan in his house. He didn't have a minyan in his house, and he would like come in different moments. So there is again, you have to know. I mean, many people say, "We don't have such great kavanah anyway. We're by ourselves, so So we really shouldn't use our need for kavana to separate from the seaborn. But there are times in which, that twice a week he could take off to have his Yisairis as they can see, right? The rest of the time he should be the seaborn, even if it compromises his command. But you should talk to your rabbi about it. That's specifically how it
works. It's in regarding the kids with Rosh Hashanah and Parnassa. Kids with Parnassa, it's Nigzar and Rosh Hashanah.
Yeah.
I've heard it said that a person can be Pasheya, and if he doesn't do enough Hashanahs, he can lose it. I've heard it said many times, and I don't know where it comes from.
Well, I think it's a Svarim debate, because the Gezerah of Rosh Hashanah is connected. The Gezerah of Rosh Hashanah is two situations. You'll get what? Meaning to say, the Gezeirah of Rosh Hashanah is not a Gezeirah Mukhlat in the sense that no matter what you do, it's a Gezeirah that's in kosher to a certain doctrine of Hishtat, which of course is, creates a total unknown equation. Now, you're right, the Chaimus Olavavus is not Mashma. The Chaimus Olavavus is Mashma. You're going to get what you're going to get. How will Hashem Cheshbin Eis if you don't do Hishtadlis? How is it going to work? I don't know. But the Chaimus Olavavus is Mashma. But the Svarim that say you could be mopsin, it's not really, it's not knas. It's based on the fact that the etzem gezeira itself is along a range of infinite possibilities. As far as the cheshbetz, the amount of ishtablus, and the parnasa is makusher to that amount of.
Where does that come from?
Huh?
Where does that come from? That Svarim.
Where's what? I have to see what the mucker is. I mean, it's brought down in many places. I would check. Maybe it does make it.
It's also, that's the same thing applies to the Gezeira 40 days before the plot, the Gezeira Shemayim. It says there also it's decided will be rich or poor.
Well, there you see Beferish in the Gemara. That's the only need that I know it does here. There you see Beferish in the Gemara that you could be Maksim. The Gemara says you're allowed to make a Shidduch even in the 9 days. Maybe somebody through tefillah will take away your bashir. So there you see for a double question that one could be mopsed as bashir either by a lack of schutz or even not a lack of schutz. Somebody else has an extra schutz of a kayak for tefillah. So there you have a perish about it. And because that was likely, you know, I don't have another chair. He said you measured bashir 5 years ago, you didn't want to go out. So it's probably not the case that everybody marries that particular one that you make sure. But that doesn't mean that it can work with them giving away a tachlis, and then it can work in the second stage as well. It's not like a different shaming.
What is a talmud chacham?
Well, you know, the Rama says, the talmud chacham has a lot of privileges in the world. Doesn't have to pay taxes, all sorts of things. Remember the IRS or even the Israeli tax authority, the Ramas, has not accepted that yet. But the Ramas says on that, nobody's a Talmud Chacham. Nobody doesn't have to pay their taxes. But the definition of a Talmud Chacham, again, like everything else, we throw around the words today. Chaim Eicher once said, Chaim Eicher would get letters from all over the world, and the letters would have many, many titles. He was deserving of the titles. Rabbi Shul called me Abdullah. He was given the greatest titles. But he would laugh in his Anaga. He would laugh and he would say, which reminded him, you know, if you remember in the Weimar Republic before World War II, after World War I, inflation was so, that's really how the Nazis got into power. The inflation was so excessive that you had to use a billion marks to buy a loaf of bread. May have seen the newsreel of pictures of people with wheelbarrows and wheelbarrows of money to get a piece of bread. So Chaim Eicher says the inflation of titles in the Torah books is reminding him of the inflation of the bread in Germany, where you know the person who was a rab is now a rab again, and the person who was a gain is a gain. I don't, you know, everything is the question. Of Chaim Eicher's case, that was I would have to say false modesty, but in some ways everything is in inflation today. Here you have a guy in yeshiva, you know, who's been learning Gemara for 2 years, he gets engaged. say, the fine tamakash, which will be a fine tamakash, and leg. But the Rama says the definition of a tamakash is it's a big definition. It's a hard definition. It's someone that you can ask him anywhere in chat, and he will be able to explain it to you. And it even has, including Maseches Kala. Maseches Kala is not even part of the regular Shas. It's the Maseches, the small Maseches. They're like appendix Maseches and the like. So the Chazanish explains what that means is, not just to translate the line of Gemara, but it means in any sugya in Shas, he could give you the Iker, Gemara, and the Rishonim. It doesn't mean only the greatest Gedolim are holding in every sugya all the time. But he has to be able to address it, right? So now that's the objective definition. Now, the truth of the matter is, in some ways, inflation is justifiable in the sense that when a door gets weaker and weaker, so you need to give chizik to people. So when people finish a lot of the settlers and learn a lot of Gemara, you know, they should get some recognition for their accomplishments. But the Talmid Chacham, according to the Rama's definition, is you could ask him in, I think the Lashon is Rav Sugya Sashat, and he's able to be Meshiv. Some have given a more limited definition. They have said he's able to be Meshiv in three Siddharim of Shas. What are the three Siddharim of Shas, as you would guess? Nashim, Nizikin, Moed, because maybe Zerayim, Kachim, Tyros, although Zerayim is very Nogea today in Eretz Yisrael, but for most of the Golus, it was not Nogea of the Maisa. So we'll let him off the hook for Zerayim, Kachim, Tyros. But at least Nashim, Moed, Nashim, Nizikin, he should know. Now, one other thing I want to say about the Talmud Chacham, and that is, it's very, very interesting that literally, what is the translation of the Talmud Chacham? The Talmud Chacham, actually, it's an ambiguous translation. It could mean student of the wise, or it could mean a wise student. Right? But either way, you'll notice that we call the person a Talmud. Now, you might say, for example, Rebbe Yashiv was the greatest Talmud Chacham of the generation. Whoever you want to pick as your God. But it's funny, Talmud Chacham? Talmud? The Bible Muster say a beautiful word. They say that the true son of Godless and Torah is no matter how much you know, you still want to know. I mean, you're still a Talmud. You still want to keep on going. Because when you think, I know it already, then by definition, you haven't used that word. So the word Talmud Chacham is a very extraordinary term because it suggests that the Iker thing that's Koveya Godless and Torah is the Shi'ifa, the desire to keep on going. That's why I remember, what does the Gemara say? The Gemara says that, why are Talmidei Chachamim called fish? The Talmud of fish, so it mentions that a fish lives in water, a fish is surrounded by water. But when it's raining, and it looks like drops of water are hitting, the fish swim up to the top to take in a little more water. Now, the truth is, they think it's worms. But it looks, at least visually, it looks like they're going after the water. So too, a Talmud Chacham is surrounded with Torah. But he hears another voice, another Ha'ara, another Daher. He rushes. That's when they say that the Archibald got a publicity picture once, really. They really could have used this in their advertising. Rabbi Yashiv was looking at the Hebrew Shabbos, the Archibald Hebrew version. And he was looking at a picture.
We have plenty of people who use our marketing.
Now, what was he looking at? Well, here you have a person who's been learning, you know, almost 100 years. He was learning 100 years, more for 100 years. And looking at the art scroll, you know, what is he looking at? You know, even in the second, they don't let you look at the art scroll. Maybe he would let you look at it. But the answer is, this is my the example. You know, the guys who write the art scroll are Chashuv HaKalel people who have done research and they looked up Mara Makamas. So Rabbi Yashiv think, maybe I'll get something new. Amazing thing. Like the fish. Maybe there's a little lower here. I'll learn from somebody who's 75 years, you know, younger than me. Maybe he came up with something. I'll just end with this, Rabbi Yashiv Silver. He was a great Gadol. He came from Europe and he came to America in 1920, so he was in America before World War II. He was very influential in helping Jews out of the Holocaust and enlightenment. His first stellar was in a New England town, I don't want to mention it, super much in Harlan's town, and he was relatively young, and he was fired from the rabbinate in the 1920s. And the reason he was fired was he was spending night times in the synagogue learning Gemara, and they thought he was wasting electricity. They didn't want a rabbi who was wasting electricity. So when he said, well, you know, I'm learning, they said, ah, that's the whole point. You know, we want a rabbi who finished his education. You're learning, you're getting your degree at our expense, get out of here. Now we want somebody who knows his stuff. You know, so what can I tell you? Just the Musa that, you know, you learn Torah, then you're finished, then you graduate, is something that Baruch Hashem, I think, is so foreign to all of us, that we understand that keeps on, one keeps on going. So there's a Hashem, we should all be able to keep on going. And as Rav Reisman said, we too are in the army. People are big, we're not just here where we are, but yet since we are in the army, and we should feel that we're in the army. Because the Avodas Hashem and the Torah that you learn is bringing Siyata Dishmaya and Bracha on this earth. And we should take it very, very seriously. The same way that a military soldier should not abandon his post. It's very, very serious. So too, a Ben Torah has to realize not to abandon the post. That's why this small gesture, for the Shem every moment, as a Hashivas, she was extending the Torah at least by a few days. Some Hasidic places have literally canceled Ben Hasmani. Now, if you ask, why did we cancel Ben Hasmani? So, this is a difficult shikol. There is a logical reason that there ought not to be a Ben Hasmani at all. But you also have to look at the long-term consequences. There's not going to be a Ben Hasmani at all. Elzman, you know, people will be exhausted and tired. So, in a sense, you have to weigh every Rosh Hashiva has to weigh the qualitative benefits in learning by giving people a break versus the sacrifice and the quantum. And who says what's going to be a bigger success? Is it a bigger success that people can learn with more Islamists, or is it a bigger success to learn without interruption? So these are difficult shikulim, and different rabbanim, different Rosh Hashivas have come out different ways. But for Steinman, it's kind of the level that we're following, seems to indicate that we should try to compromise by both extending this model and also still giving to Ben Hasmani. But still, Ben Hasmani doesn't mean you have to be part of it. You are allowed to learn Ben Hasmani. It's not us or the land. And certainly, whatever a person is able to do, consistent with their needs for rest and relaxation, which is a need, should try to do, because again, we do need this physical Torah in time of great suffering. Anyway, I'm sorry, I can't say I'm going to say it. I just want to wish everyone a tremendous yesterday. I'm much more than you did. Much, much more. Very, very beautiful.